This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Across Northern Ireland, on your radio and on BBC Sounds. This is
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Sectarian attacks on new houses in Antrim. Can you believe this is still happening here in 2024? We get the very latest. And we're also looking ahead to this week's general election. Only three more sleeps. And we're trying to answer the biggest question of all. Are you going to vote? Or are you going to be on holiday? It is the start of July after all. So what's more important? Going sunbathing or voting here at home? Enjoy the program.
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Good morning. What a terrible start to July. Don't worry, we're going to cheer you up. Thanks for tuning in. And if you are listening to us from sunny Spain on BBC Sounds, like many do, we're not jealous at all. But I do wonder just how many people are now on holiday and are going to miss that big vote on Thursday. We're going to talk about that shortly. But first, to Antrim and those sectarian attacks on new houses. It does appear to be just simply naked sectarianism. Last week, curbstones were painted red, white and blue at this new social housing development just outside Antrim town. Pro-union flags were also put up then. Early yesterday morning, around 3 o'clock in the morning, in the dead of night, what cards? A gang arrived and attacked at least two homes with paint and some windows were broken. Police are treating the incident as a sectarian motivated hate crime. And indeed, the Irish News is reporting, I've just got a copy in front of me and I can see they're reporting that one of the houses which was attacked was a house which had recently been specially adapted to accommodate a disabled 9-year-old boy who's due to move in with his family shortly. Shocking. We're going to talk to Alison Morris from the Belfast Telegraph in a moment, and also the political commentator David Graham and the former senior police officer John Burrows. But just to get more of a sense of this housing development, we're going to talk to Cathy again. We heard from Cathy last week. Cathy, good morning again. You were offered a house in this development and decided against it. Is that right?
That's right, Mark, yeah.
Remind us why. Had there been any form of intimidation at that stage?
Initially, when I was offered the house, no. There were no flags, no curbstones had been painted. The house is just further off the road. I was very aware of the Ballycraigie area across the way from it. And that was all fine. As I've already said, I'm happy enough to live side by side. Other different cultures, but just thinking that this wee row of houses, you know, newly built, thinking it's a shared space. But once I seen the flags go up, and I did make a few phone calls to see whose responsibility it was to remove those. Once I started to get the runaround with that already instilled a sinister kind of feeling for me.
How did you feel, Cathy? Sorry to interrupt, when you heard the news then about what happened in the early hours of yesterday morning.
Well, that, Mark, is actually, that's really scary. I mean, it's intimidation. It is blatant intimidation. I don't know the setup with the person meant to have that house, but what person in their right mind does that to a disabled child, no matter what colour or creed you are? What is wrong with people?
Yeah, there's a picture in the front of the Irish News of this young lad, only 9 years of age, in his wheelchair. And of course, this house had been specially adapted, hoist put in, lots of stuff at ground level to be able to accommodate him and his family. Do you think, Cathy, knowing society as it is here, even in 2024, anything could be done now to try and reassure that family?
I really am at a loss. I mean, the use of flags and emblems as intimidation. I mean, there should be a policy or a legislation in place that social housing areas, public places, should not be marked like that at all. Really, in this country, what what really can people do? These morons take the law onto themselves, and use these flags and colours to intimidate people. So I don't really actually know what can be done, but at least there should be a law set in place that it is absolutely illegal to do that.
Cathy, thank you. We have a statement from the PSNI Chief Superintendent Jeremy Lindsay says, I want to reassure the community that we are treating these incidents extremely seriously and we are carrying out a robust investigation which is ongoing. I would appeal to the community to assist our ongoing investigation and to report any concerns they may have. Let's talk to the Belfast Telegraph's Alison Morris, to the commentator David Graham, and also the former senior police officer John Burrows. John Burrows, good morning. Picking up on what Cathy just said, in fairness to the PSNI, they can't patrol every housing development 24/7. Is it a law change that's needed here?
Good morning, Mark. First of all, what a cowardly attack. And I think, you know, what stands out about it is the time of the night. In the middle of the night, people have come out and actually had to be planned and organised and motivated to get the paint and go out and actually damage someone's home. So despicable. I think there's a strategy needed around this. So first of all, yes, the police need to robustly investigate, but that is reactive in its nature. And often it is very difficult to solve crimes like this. Yes, they'll do door-to-door appeals. Yes, they'll check for ring doorbells and all those other things. And they'll put out a media inquiry and we'll hope, and by the way, that somebody notices somebody in their household or family or friend who has come home with paint on their clothes or their shoes or whatever. But, you know, the chance of solving it is fairly small. It's important the public can help where they can, but it's fairly small. So I think we need a broad strategy to prevent this in the first place. And that needs political leadership, and it needs civic leadership, and then it needs the support of the justice agencies. Because we need to actually make it very clear that this is not patriotism, that this is not acceptable, that this is not what we do. And our politicians need to get together and get a strategy, because what is happening in Northern Ireland is across the society, there are areas that are marked out, green and orange. You're not welcome here if you don't belong in those or perceived to belong in those areas. So this is learned behaviour. This doesn't come out as a bolt out of the blue. This is learned behaviour. It's been going on for decades. And the politicians need to get round and get a clear, robust strategy. And then that needs to be enforced and led.
John, I'll come back to you and ask you what that strategy may look like. Alison Morris, what's your take on what happened at the weekend?
Well, the little boy you're talking about, his name's Jesse Clark. He was actually in the front of yesterday's Sunday World, and I went into the garage originally to get a coffee and to grab papers from my dad. And there was a man in front of me staring at the front page. And I'll not tell you the kind of language he used in relation to the people that did this and wrecked the house that has been specially built for that child. And I think that his views are pretty much the same as anyone who has read that story and what they would think. They're writing locals only on these houses. This child is local and this house has been built especially for him, so that at some point in his life he'll have independence, because it has harnesses and hoists and things that means he'll be able to go to the bathroom and shower himself. So who is this? Who do they want this house for? If not for the child it was built for, who is it that they'd like this house to be given to? And why don't they come and tell us that? Because I'm quite happy to drive up there and speak to whoever it is, and they can explain to me what it is that frightens them so much about a little child in a wheelchair, that they have to wreck a house before they let him go and live in it. That his mother has been waiting years on the housing list, years, to the point where there was no property that was suitable for this child's needs, and one has had to be built to be especially adapted to his needs, and now they're destroying it so that the child can't move into it, and every one of them should be ashamed. In terms of the policing response, flags can be removed. They can be removed if there's a chance that those flags are going to cause violence if they remain where they are, and I think that's pretty much the case in this point. And then there's also the criminal damage element and the damage that's being done to these brand new houses at a time of a really bad housing shortage. And a lot of this is being orchestrated. It's not just being done by individuals. It's being orchestrated, in a lot of cases, orchestrated by paramilitary organisations. And the PSNI have other ways of intelligence and covert human intelligence sources and all sorts of other ways of finding out what they're doing. And I think, you know, putting more resources into trying to find out who these people are would benefit all of society, because this is meant to be shared housing, And we know, Mark, looking at recent the last census, that more and more people do not consider themselves strongly British or strongly Irish. There's a large group of people who consider themselves Northern Irish, people who are of mixed families or none, people who don't really have a very strong identity, and people who want to live in a shared housing estate with people from all different kinds of religions and backgrounds, because that's what way they want their children to be brought up. They don't want them to be brought up in a single identity community. And that's something that we should be encouraging and facilitating. But, I mean, to me, I think the fact that this house was meant for wee Jesse, it's his home, and he's all excited. His mother says, grandparents were both in the paper yesterday saying how excited he was about moving into this house because he was going to have his own room with his own purpose-built bathroom to it. And now this child is left again homeless. I mean, who are these people? Come and explain what it is that's terrifying you so much about a wee child in a wheelchair that you're going to have to wreck a house before you allow his family to move into it.
Alison, I was interested by your offer to intervene. Why are you saying that you would speak to these people? Do you believe that?
I would like them to explain what it is that they're so afraid of, what it is that terrifies them about who is going to be living in these houses, that they think that they're such a threat to their identity that they'd rather destroy them than see people move into a home. That to me fascinates me, because clearly there's a train of thought here. They believe it. What? What is coming? The galloping hordes are coming to move into these houses. Who is it they think is moving into it? And why do they frighten them so much? Why do they frighten them to the point where they're destroying these properties at a time when there's a really bad housing crisis? Why are they destroying these homes? And if they have an articulate reason why, if they have genuine reason why they think that Jesse shouldn't have his home, well, then I'd come and interview them. I'd come and speak to them. They can tell me. And let's hear it out. Let's hear it out. Other than creeping around in the middle of the night like cards, why don't they just come out and say what it is that they're so afraid of?
Well, I'm just looking through the Irish News, and as you say, Jesse featured in the Sunday World yesterday. It is hard to imagine how anyone could stop that wee fella getting the home that he's dreamt of. Alison, I mean, you've covered a lot of things here before, and, you know, some of us get a little bit almost immune, but I can hear it in your voice. Is it because you're a mum, or are you just fed up that this is still happening in 2024?
You know, when I read yesterday, his disabilities are very specific. They're very specific to him, and they're very complex. And his mother was looking after him. She's a single mother. She's looking after him on his own. And the grandmother said, from now, and he's getting bigger. You can see he's getting a bigger chair. He'll continue to get bigger. And this woman has been carrying him upstairs and carrying him in and out of bathrooms, trying to get him washed. And can you imagine the joy at knowing you were going to have this specially adapted home, one that was going to allow your child freedom and independence, that his wee wheelchair had bigger doors, so be able to move around on his own. He didn't have to rely on other people. And eventually, when he got bigger, he would be able to use the hoist and get himself to the shower and be independent. And for any, you know, for any child, especially a child with a disability like that, it must have been thinking, this is going to be great. I have my own room, and thinking about what way going to decorate that room. And for someone to just destroy something like that, for what reason? For some kind of tribalised reason, it's absolutely disgraceful. And whoever they are, you know, the whole of society should be pointing and shaming them, because it's a disgrace. It's an utter disgrace. This isn't just, oh, you know, we don't want someone from a different community coming and living beside us. This is, unless we get to dictate who lives in these homes, we're going to destroy them. And think about what kind of mentality you'd have to be so entrenched that you'd rather no one had a home than have homes with, you know, that lovely wee family living beside you. What harm are they going to do living, you know, a few feet from whoever it is, or however far it is from the person who's doing this?
Let's bring in the political commentator, David Graham. Good morning, David. What's your take on this?
Well, I think, Margaret...
Oh, David. We've got you back.
I think, Mark, from a unionist point of view, it's a sad, sad situation, particularly given the fact that today is the 1st of July, and we think back to 108 years ago when, you know, unionist forefathers and those from other backgrounds, both the 14th Irish Division and the 36th Ulster Division, went over the top for freedom and democracy. And 108 years later, Mark, you've got people who are masquerading as loyalists, masquerading as unionists, and I think it's a stain in society, and I trust that the people are finding the perpetrators.
David, your line isn't great. We're going to come back to you. Let's go to John Burrows. I'll give you a bit of thinking time. What should the new strategy be, John, to stop this happening?
Well, you know, it has to be multifaceted, Mark, end to end. So, yeah, there'll be a criminal justice approach. There'll be, you know, really robust sentencing. There'll be diversion schemes so that if someone is caught right now committing this sort of activity or is getting drawn into this kind of activity through, you know, when they're detected at interface violence, that there's a program ready for them to be diverted into. So you've got the tough sentencing, you've got the diversion and education programs that can then get upstream of this, get into schools. Political role modelling, I think, is really important. You know, I think right from every councillor, right through to your MPs and the MLAs in the middle, that they should be having the approach, the philosophy. And, you know, some people use this in Derry very effectively. An attack on one of us is an attack of all of us. You know, still too often we see those on the unionist side speaking out more vociferously about attacks on their own community and vice versa, those who are on the Republican nationalist side. I'm not saying they don't condemn it, but there seems to be more traction, I think, depending on where it comes from. We need to see real political leadership. And, you know, we need to get tough on this. This is linked to all of the memorials and the murals and the symbolisation that has celebrated and eulogised terrorism, paramilitarism, murder, division, segregation. All of that stuff needs to be addressed. There are things put up without planning permission. There are songs sung in festivals that are funded by the council that are full of hatred. You know, we actually need to get tough on this and say, look, we don't want to live like this.
What does tough look like, John? What do you mean? Stiffer sentences?
Well, that is simply that, A, the politicians live up to that. That B, there are things like stipulations if we're going to give public money to anything, that there's an anti-sectarianism plan, that public money can be recalled if there's displays of gratuitous sectarianism at public events. Because what you start doing is creating a consequence. You start saying in this place, that is not acceptable here. And, you know, you need to do that. We need to sit down with the statutory agencies. And I mean, the councils around planning permission, all the different statutory agencies of the police, and say, actually, what can you do? Instead of telling us you can't take down flags.
Okay.
I had to take down a UVF, an anti-RSC border poster in my own village. Nobody else would do it. And I'm in the police. I'm sympathetic to the police. The police wouldn't do it. There was no support for it. I had to walk down myself and take it down. No one in the village wanted it. Someone had went round different areas across Northern Ireland and put the same poster up, one poster. You know, we need to get some political courage. We need to get some courage among the statutory agencies, and we need to say enough is enough. And that's why it needs to be a collective effort.
David has texted us on 81771, and he says, the truth that dare not speak its name, and I want to ask all three of you about this briefly, if you can. Mixed housing, it still doesn't work here. It's too soon. David Graham.
No, look, I think that's unfair, Mark, given the fact that there are many areas across Northern Ireland that we live in that are, in inverted commas, mixed, that have been mixed right throughout the Troubles and beyond. So I think maybe what the texter is trying to say, and I think there's a degree of rationale to it, is that manufacturing this integration where we sort of, you know, handpick people to sort of say, let's live happily ever after. Given what John has said, I don't quite agree with everything John has said, because I think going out in the dead of night and smashing up someone's house is dissimilar to putting up posters with legitimate political aspirations. But nevertheless, I think I do take his point. And I think, Mark, that the idea that we've got here links back to a conversation, in fact, that you and I have had on this very show, where we said, look, we've got an education system that we are trying to manufacture integration, but we still have other sectors which are more exclusive to particular backgrounds. So I think this is very much a chicken and egg situation. I think this is symptomatic of the divisions within society. But this idea of let's stop trying to share our future together, let's stop trying to work together, that's not for me. And I think that there's a lot more positives in Northern Ireland and a lot more that unites us than divides us.
Okay, before I bring in John and Alison on this, David, who called in from Belfast, is actually on the line. Good morning, David. Explain a little bit more what you said on text.
What I'm saying is quite clearly, mixed areas do not work. I lived in an area in Belfast that 25 years ago I moved into. I'm the only Protestant left in the area. It used to be a mixed area. It has got very much Republican attitude to it. They've attacked my home numerous occasions. I have a disabled partner in a wheelchair with life-threatening health conditions. It doesn't stop them. They keep on doing it. And anybody who thinks that the police are going to help them, take a bit of advice from somebody who's been dealing with this for 23 or the 25 years. You've no chance. They just don't do anything. So it happens on both sides of the community. I'm sorry to say it doesn't work, but it really doesn't, because sooner or later, people move into the area.
David, you can't say the police don't do anything at all.
The police have not helped us. I can't believe that. I'm quite happy. I've got 356 statements to the PSNI. I have stood for the PSNI inspectors and everything else,
okay,
and I've told them my story, and they still don't do anything.
Well, we don't have the police's side of the story We're talking about Antrim, David. We're talking about Antrim. Alison Morris, to you, in terms of Antrim and in terms of David's overall point, the mixed housing doesn't work in places like that.
I think in David's case, if he's been living in that area for 22 years, it's probably one of the very early, which were, let's face it, experimental attempts to build shared housing right after the Good Friday Agreement. And in a lot of cases, there wasn't I don't think that there was a proper negotiation or discussions with the people who were going to live in those houses as to what that meant. I think we've come on a lot. Since then, I hope we've come on a lot since then. And shared housing developments, there are more of them, and there are some of them that are working incredibly well. And the key to that is the consent of the people who live there. So, you know, when you're being offered the house, we're building this as a shared housing development, and that's something that you want. You know, you want to live somewhere where you know that your neighbours won't all be from one single identity, and that can really work. And I think that that's a really good way to look at building housing in the future. It's not the only way we should build building housing, because there's clearly all different kinds of housing needs. I think what David Graham was saying beforehand is that there are numerous parts of Northern Ireland which are completely mixed and integrated and have been. If you go right back to the Troubles, they're usually quite affluent areas, let's be honest with each other. It was where the nice middle class people lived, and therefore there was no issue in terms of flags being put up, lampposts or any of that thing, any of that kind of carry on. Whereas these are social housing that are being built specifically by housing associations as shared housing, and therefore it's people who are on a housing waiting list who have been waiting for a home, sometimes for a very long time, sometimes for years. As in this case, you know, this little boy has been waiting years because there simply was no properties in that area that suited his needs, so one had to be built. And that, I think, of course that can work. It could work. It could be lovely, and it could be a real quality of life for the people who live in it. If there weren't people who from outside who have decided no, we'll say who lives in those houses. It's our decision. You know, you don't get to decide on need. It doesn't go to the person who needs the most, it goes to who we want to be living beside. And that's the real problem. I think that the issue is not the people who choose to live in the shared housing. Mm. It's the people who are going to make a conscious decision that they want to live there. It's the people surrounding it who have decided that they don't want to live beside a shared housing development.
Well, Alison, I think, look, you're entirely right. And yeah, I certainly take your point on the more affluent areas. But I think a point that needs to be made, Mark, and there's a danger of getting into whataboutery on this subject, as there is in a lot of subjects on this show. But if you take, for example, there's a new housing and development on the Mona Bypass in West Belfast, of which there's been an application approved by Sinn Féin through a Belfast City Council committee for dual language signage or Irish language signage. Now, that's taken this conversation in a different direction, but I think there is always a danger here where, whether it is dual language signage, which then creates the idea of, is this for one side of the community, or paramilitary flags in the likes of Cantwell Close back 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, is this for another community? So I think there's a little bit of a danger here in Northern Ireland, because it's very difficult to sanitise somewhere, to take any identity off it. And I think that it's fair to say, and there are facts that stats to back this up, that people from the PUL community, if you want to crudely box people in like that, will not want to go to a housing development with Irish language signage. That's a fact, and we've seen that.
Is it fair to equate the Irish language with flags?
No, I don't. The point, I'm not necessarily equating it, Mark, and that's just saying there's a danger of getting into whataboutery, but what I am saying is that there will be people who will text into your show or call into your show to say, I wanted to live in such and such a place, but now you can fill that but in whatever way suits perhaps your agenda.
But it's very different to violence.
100% it is, Mark. And I'm of course, I'm not likening it. But what I am saying is there is a danger in Northern Ireland when we've got mixed areas which are sort of artificially designed in many ways. If they are in somewhere where Cantal Close is in East Belfast, the Mona Bypass is in West Belfast, the tradition of that particular area will be single identity, and there will be people who are either from there, or I've actually seen during my time working in South Belfast, areas that were probably traditionally, say, PUL, which the demographics begin to change. I've actually seen people, Mark, drive in and put flags up.
Who's that trying to get in? Is that you, John?
John Burrsmark. Just to come back to something David said, just to clarify, the poster I'm referring to is a UVF poster. It was a man with a balaclava pointing a gun saying no Irish Sea border. And the point
is that
99% of the people in these towns were saying, get this thing down. Nobody in authority would take it down. And we need to show and demonstrate that people have the courage to get and actually take action on this stuff.
John Burrows, thank you. Thank you to David Graham. Thank you to Alison Morris. If you live in the area and you have an insight into what's going on, please do phone us on the Nolan Show today or even contact us on email after we're off air. We're going to keep a close eye on this, and our best wishes out to Jesse and his family, this young lad, his dream house attacked at the weekend, even before he's had the chance to move in. The time is just after 9:30. Let's get a news update. Thanks for tuning in. The 1st of July. Can you believe what it's like out there? We're going to still talk about this issue in Antrim because we've had quite a few callers on this. Then we are going to talk about the weather out there and what impact this is all going to have on Thursday's election after 10 o'clock. We're going to talk about football as well. Did you see what happened to England last night? Were they lucky or did class just take a little bit of time to tell? Let's go to the lines. Tracy is there from North Belfast. Morning, Tracy.
Good morning, Mark. Mark, all I want to ask is, as I've asked before in the show, has nobody learned from what happened up in Holy Cross 20-odd years ago? What was done on children and the effect it has had on them? Now, I had two children go through that. One of them is in a mixed relationship and has babies and that in it, and is happy enough. Now, my daughter walked up through that horrendous abuse, and still and with all, my children are well balanced and came out on top. I'm so proud of them, Mark. That's what I want to say. But what really, the question I have in my mind is, it's not so much even who has done this. What age are they? Are they the same age as my children? Because I would like to know what has inceded and say these young people to go and do this if they are young. Because look at what my children come through. And yet with all, that would be the last thing that they would want to go and do, to stop somebody living, no matter what community they come from, living, and especially a special needs child, moving into a home that they so desperately need.
It's unthinkable, Tracy. It's unthinkable. Yeah. So it's also unthinkable what you and your family went through. What was that, 2001? Holy Cross, yeah. What was that, 23 years ago? What about your kid? She's not a kid anymore. How's she doing?
No, well, that's true. The older one is, both of them have degrees. The older one has the twins. She's just about to be married to her partner, Cross Community.
Did it take a while to get over all of that?
It broke me, Mark. I had two nervous breakdowns from it, and I'm probably seen as a local mad woman from then. But my younger one is doing her master's in psychotherapy. So, and they are well-balanced youngsters, and sometimes it would maybe correct me because I would go off the rails a bit sometimes about it, because there was lots of things in my family. We had lots of murders. Up in City Cemetery, we have like four or five people murdered, and also in the Milltown as well, from my family. So you just sort of trundled on through. I seen bombs. I went over and seen my cousin who was shot dead, run in and found him. Lots of people are the same.
Well, listen, thanks for phoning in. Look after yourself. Mind yourself, as they say. That's Tracy in North Belfast. Thomas, also in Belfast. Morning, Thomas.
Good morning, Mark. See where that estate is. If you cross the road, it's an older estate. There's a corner house there that has been boarded up for months, and there was a family coming out of that property. Now, my question is, in my eyes, how is it always Catholics are people of colour who are not accepted in Protestant estates?
I don't want to do whataboutery here, Thomas, but it's not always one way.
Well, I would like to see the figures, but I would say it's predominantly that just do not seem to want to tolerate anyone who isn't a Protestant, a loyalist, or whatever. You know, that's the impression that I'm getting. And I'm old enough, Mark, to remember the Quinn brothers in 1998. So is that going to take another one of those? Like, there's no one learned a lesson.
Thomas, did you hear David earlier on talking about kind of the only Protestant in the village where he lives?
I heard David, yes. And listen, it's all wrong. Don't get me wrong. It's all wrong. But these guys will profess to be loyalists. They'll be out, no doubt, over the 12th celebrations, and they'll be remembering the Somme and the men that went over the top and the World Wars. Those men would be turning in their graves because they went out to fight for everyone's freedom and rights.
That's a very good point. Thomas, thank you. I appreciate you calling in to the Nolan Show, even though it's the Simpsons Show today. Let's keep going on the callers, will we? Yeah, we'll go to the football and we'll go to the election in a moment because you are phoning in. We really, really appreciate it. James, what's on your mind, James?
Hey, look, I'm just going to be in a marriage type of thing, right? I'd be quite happy, you know, moving into Snugwell Street. I'd feel more safe in Snugwell Street than I would be in Antrim, Carrick, Fergus, and other outlying areas. Seems to be they're getting away with a murder and then type of places, you know. I think the Sangal and the New North Road people are, you know, 100% brilliant people. And the Sank and the Falls and the Bowdoin, whatever, they're all lovely, a lot of decent people. I'd be happy enough going into Snuggle Street and put my furniture in the door.
James, thank you for the call. Appreciate it. Not a great line, James. I'm sorry. Brian in Lambeg. What's your point, Brian?
Hi, Mark. Maybe there's more to it than just pure blatant sectarianism.
Elaborate.
If you take Antrim to there's new part.
Oh, Brian. Let's trade you in for another Brian while we try and sort out that line. We're not having a good day on the phone lines. Must be the bad weather. Brian in Belfast. Morning, Brian.
Morning, Mark. Mark, you mentioned at the top of the programme what can be done about these things. Well, nothing. Because I'm old enough, I'm a pensioner. This goes on every year. My grandchildren are growing up with this every year. Their grandchildren will probably be on this particular programme when they get older. And after that again, it's not going to change, Mark. It happens every year. And you ask, I've been on the programme many times about this particular situation every year. It happens every year during the 12 celebrations. The hate comes out. That word hasn't been used very much this morning. And that's what it is, hate. And unfortunately, it's not going to change. I haven't heard any condemnation from any well-known unionist politician.
Well, I can tell you it has been condemned.
Well,
Brian, the big picture is here. I take your point. It hasn't gone away, sectarianism, but things are a lot better than when you and I were young.
Oh, I agree with you there because I was going to mention too, I have two daughters who live in a mixed area. No problems at all. So it does work.
There you are.
For some callers, you know. And I mean, thank God for all that.
Mm.
But what I'm saying, Mark, is the same problems happen every year at this particular month. And we all know that. And that's not going to change, unfortunately.
Brian, thanks for calling. And thanks for pointing out that you have two daughters living in a mixed area. Things are bad, yes, and maybe particularly at this time of the year, but they're a lot better. My goodness, they're a lot better than the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. Let's take one more call on this. Peter in Carrickfergus. Morning, Peter. The last caller on this for the day.
Well, I find it distressing that you're listening to these same people? Peter, or the guy on before, is always on the same subject when I raises, and I still think it's bad that people can pull out names like Carrick, Fergus, Mid-Antrim. There's many people of colour down here. Patterson and Caffey said, well, the colour, no issues. And I think it's wrong. And at the end of the day, those wonderful people on talking to you now, they can't even wait that a 10-minute walk go by because they're so loving and caring. You know what I mean? It works everywhere.
Peter, thank you. Could you answer another question just while you're on the line? I don't know if you've looked out your window at all today. Do you think many people are still about on election week, or a lot of people in Carrickfergus now on holiday?
There's a lot of people on holiday. It was probably just a bad time, but, you know, they'll probably come out. If they've any sense and really want to do something, they'll be out. And if they don't come out and vote, they deserve it to get. You know what I mean?
There you are. Thank you. Thank you, Peter. Well, there are only three more sleeps until the general election. It's the first July election here for almost 80 years, and we know what that means.
We're all going on a summer holiday. No more working for a week or two. Fun and laughter on a summer holiday, no more worries for me or you for a week or two. We're going.
Oh, Cliff Richard, you can't beat a bit of Cliff to cheer us all up, and especially on the day that Wimbledon starts. But this is election week, and as we know, a lot of people, once the schools get out, decide, you know what, I'm getting out of here. I'm maybe going to Spain or France, or going to my holiday home, or maybe going to stay with family elsewhere. And even if you're within reach of your home constituency, will you come back on Thursday to vote? We know polling stations open at 7 o'clock in the morning. They close at 10 o'clock at night. I'm going to talk to Tina McKenzie, the business leader, in a moment. Anne Watt, director of the political think tank Pivotal. Former Downing Street media chief Tom Kelly. And the new Queen's University Student Union president Kieran Minto in a moment. But first of all, let's see how big the exodus is. Heather Fielding is managing director of Gallagher's Travel in Derry. Good morning, Heather.
Good morning, Mark.
Is it just me, or does what, 10, 15% of the population here tend to disappear for the first 2 weeks in July, or July, or is it not as bad as that?
I would say it's probably, it could be even slightly higher than that. I think because of such bad weather as well over the last kind of month or so, that we've seen a peak in demand, you know, as well. People looking for that last minute getaway. People maybe weren't planning to go away until later on and thinking, no, we can't wait. We want to get away now, sooner rather than later. They're even taking the kids out of school. They were taking the kids out of school a few days early, that kind of thing. So definitely it is, yeah, very, very busy.
And I said, what, 10 or 15% of the population? What would your guesstimate be?
It's hard to know. It just seems like, when I look at the books today, it seems like everybody's away at the moment. So that's just what it feels like here. But, you know, saying that, you know, sometimes when people are looking at last minute things, and I sometimes jokingly say to them, I say, oh, you'll be away for the election. Doesn't fizz with them at all. They don't seem to kind of, it doesn't take anything into account at all. So they just want to get away. That's what they want to do. And that's what we're here to do, is kind of get people what they want at the end of the day.
And two last things. I mean, you maybe don't have the stats at your fingertips, but statistically, in your experience, even in Derry, are the first 2 weeks in July normally the busiest holiday period of the year?
Yeah, they definitely are. And they're probably the most expensive as well, because sometimes we find later on in the summer the prices kind of come down a wee bit. Where we are as well, we're right on the border. So a lot of the schools in the south finish a bit earlier, especially the secondary schools. So there is that demand kind of from middle of June onwards for us here. We are on the border. So definitely, I would say for us, the first 2 weeks is really busy and the prices start to go down a wee bit, and then they go back up again for the kind of the last week in July, first week in August, and then there's a wee bit of a lull again, and then the last week of the school holidays, up they go again.
When's the Derry fortnight, remind me?
Your guess is as good as mine at the minute, because it's all over the place.
Right.
But it's normally that last week in July,
first week
in August, sometimes the first 2 weeks in August, it depends. There's no hard and fast rule really on that anymore.
You can tell I married a Strabane woman. Just before you go, Heather, are we back to kind of pre-COVID levels in terms of the number of us going on holiday now? Are we back to normal?
I would say we probably are.
Okay.
Still, people are a wee bit skeptical. You know, there's still, you get the usual. For us, we would have, like, obviously this is a family time, but for us, September time is really, really busy. The couples, people trying to avoid, the school holidays and that kind of thing as well. So what we are finding this year, the people maybe that haven't been away from before COVID are back again, whereas last year people were a wee bit more hesitant. So hopefully things back to nearly what they were before. But so if we can just get more operators coming in, more destinations, that's what we're looking for now.
Heather, thank you. We wish you well. I might be giving you a phone after the programme, having looked out the window here. But it'll have to be post-election. I'm going to be around on Thursday. Let's go through our panel very, very quickly. I'll go to you first, Tina McKenzie. In a sentence, are you going to be around on Thursday and are you going to vote?
Oh, I'm definitely going to be around. I'll be flying back from Edinburgh to vote. So for sure I'll be here. But I guess, like everyone else, if I had a holiday planned, I'd be off on my holidays, probably not worrying about it like most people. I think they've got so much else to worry about now in terms of their mortgages, childcare costs. Things seem a bit depressing for people in terms of making ends meet. So if they do get the ability to get a holiday, get off to the caravan or, get off to Spain or wherever, then you can't really blame them. If they've booked a holiday, then they should go and just enjoy themselves.
What about you?
I'm going on holiday on Thursday, Mark, but I'll be voting before I go. So that is a complete coincidence. Holiday booked months and months ago, but allows us to get to the polling station first. So that's good. I mean, obviously, people who are going to be away kind of applied for a postal vote. The deadline for that is well past now, but that is there, you know, to make provision for people who are unable to be in the polling station because they're on holiday or maybe because they're working or something. So there is provision for that. We do know that postal vote applications are up 50%.
Wow.
From the last election. So people have actually done that to make sure they do get their vote, even if they're away. Or Tom, some people have anyway.
Tom Kelly, what about you?
Oh, I'll be voting. I would never miss an election. Sometimes I've had to put in a postal vote. Sometimes I've had to fly back from London and scrape in at 9:15 at night. But you know, the moment of putting that X next to the preferred candidate or the least not preferred candidate is for me almost a sacred duty.
A sacred duty. I'll come back to you in a moment, Tom, about why you would call an election in July. Did the Prime Minister forget about us? Anyway, Kieran Minto, tell us about your logistics around Thursday. Are you going to be able to vote?
I will indeed. I'll be voting at home and then travelling up to Belfast for work.
Congratulations, by the way. This is your first day in your new job.
It is indeed. We're about half an hour in. So.
Half an hour in. You're the new Queen's University Student Union president, so you know all about elections. Tom, back to you. Do you think we were, and Scotland, of course, is in holiday mode at this time of the year as well. Do you think we were an afterthought when it came to Rishi Sunak picking the date?
I'm afraid there's only one answer to that, and that is yes. Look, this is an awkward election for Northern Ireland, not just in terms of holiday, but also in terms of where we are in the formation of the executive, which hasn't really had a chance to get beyond photo calls. So I don't think there is a single party in Northern Ireland that would have chosen this time of year for an election. I think, mind you, there's many in the Conservative Party who, even at the time of calling an election, might also have thought it was a bit daft and might think so even more now. But, you know, the Prime Minister, it is one of the things that is the Prime Minister's absolute right to choose a date, and he did so.
And Tom, knowing politics here as you do, what impact could a slightly lower turnout have?
I think it depends on whether that lower turnout applies across all the parties. Look, the DUP have had a horrible time of late. They will be worried. Sinn Féin haven't yet, in my view, completely absorbed the impact of their disappointing performance down south. For Alliance, does Naomi Long, would she really have chosen this time when she's just getting her feet under the table again? As Justice Minister, would she have chosen this time? So, you know, for all the parties, I think this is awkward.
Awkward. Tina McKenzie, you were that soldier once when you were involved in party politics. Thankfully, you've gone on to bigger and better things, you might say. What's your view on a July election?
Yeah, well, I know from, you know, I run Staffline, Mark, and we've about 4,500, 5,000 people out working every day. We're the probably largest provider in Northern Ireland. So I can see clearly with the amount of bookings, the amount of places that have an actual shutdown, factories and warehouses, a lot of them will close and ask people to take their holidays. So for sure, I think there are a lot of people, they start to tend to close down kind of Wednesday this week and then shut down for 10 days. So we can see it in our temps out, how many people are not going to be out working and they're taking holidays. So I think that's going to affect it. But I mean, ultimately, when you look at it, I mean, I ran, as you know, to be an MEP, and there weren't very many of us running at the time. But with this particular election, I think it's really interesting. Number one, first past the post. So, you know, as Tom says, sometimes it's strategic about who you're trying to get out rather than who you're trying to get in, because there's a lot of people running that probably don't have much chance of getting in. And then you've got, you know, that we're 18 seats of 650. You know, Scotland gets 71 seats, Wales 32, and we get 18 simply because of our population. So you've heard a lot in this election about, can we really make a difference? But we have seen with the whole Brexit debate and where you get hung parliaments, where Northern Ireland is really, can be really, really important to the bigger parties. But equally, you know, I spend a lot of time in London now on behalf of small businesses. And I have to tell you, there is, sometimes we can feel left behind, but there is an interest in, you know, keeping Northern Ireland at peace, looking at what can be done to support Northern Ireland. No one wants Northern Ireland going backwards after all the progress we've made. But ultimately, we're getting to the stage now of hopefully getting into closer and closer of some sort of normal politics. So it's interesting to see the seats in Northern Ireland that are actually, you know, really potentially going to move, and what difference that will make here locally. So I think it's a fascinating election for maybe 3 or 4 seats anyway, for sure.
Tina, you're still sounding like a politician. You ever tempted to make a comeback?
I am asked that all the time for some reason. tempted right now? Absolutely not. Okay. I'm loving getting my politics from supporting small businesses at the FSB. So that's my little head on it, Mark.
Yeah, there's politics everywhere, not just in terms of elections. Pete Blakely's on the line from Ballyhalber. Morning, Pete. You want us all to be forced to vote, is that right?
Yeah, that's right, Mark. I mean, at the minute, the turnout is in the sort of 40%. And I don't know what it's going to be like this time with so many people going on holiday. But it's not democratic if less than 50% of the people in the country are deciding what happens. In Australia, quite simply, if you don't vote, you get fined. And that means that in Australia, average votes are in the 90%. And that is democratic. That's what needs to happen here.
Pete, thank you. Interesting suggestion. What? You're a big believer in democracy. What do you think about that idea?
Well, turnout here in the last general election was 62%. It was 65.5% the one before that. So it's not down in the 40s. It is a bit higher than that. People here tend to vote more in assembly elections as well. So they're more connected, I think, to the assembly because they know that that's where decisions about day-to-day things like, you know, health service, education, infrastructure, roads, all of that stuff is decided in the assembly. So compulsory voting, I think, I don't know, I'd be in favour of saying, you know, it's somebody's right not to vote. I think if you have compulsory voting, you would get people who would, you know, they'd be forced to go to the polling station, but if they're that disengaged, they'll just spoil the ballot paper. And then you create a whole administrative system of pursuing people who didn't vote, and you'd think, is that really worthwhile? Is that a good use of public resources? So, you know, I think we want to encourage as many people to be on the electoral register, to get out there and exercise the democratic right on Thursday. But I do think part of that is saying you don't actually want to as well.
And Anne, it's not really on the political radar of any political party here within the UK or Ireland, I think. Is it compulsory voting?
I don't think so. No. The bigger issue, actually, which is coming out and is in a number of the local parties' manifestos, and I think in the Labour Party manifesto, is votes for younger people, so votes at 16, which is already in place in Scotland for Scottish Parliament elections and local elections. So in Scotland, they have a weird situation now of where young people who are 16 or 17 vote in Scottish elections, but they don't vote in the UK general election. And so there's a number of the parties here want to extend voting to a younger age, and there's quite a lot of support for that. So we might see more debate about that coming up.
Speaking of young people, Ciarán Minto is still on the line. Ciarán, what was the turnout like in your election to become Queen's University Student Union president?
The overall turnout was around 6K, which was our highest ever and a great achievement for us.
6K out of roughly what?
25,000, but that is very on par for the sector, and we were one of the highest university turnouts across the UK.
Okay, I notice why then you didn't give me a percentage. That's less than 50%. And what about your view on the ground in terms of whether we should make voting compulsory?
I don't really have a specific view on mandatory voting. I'm not overly fussed on sort of the gimmicks of it. I think that students are already engaged with the whole election process. The National Union of Students, their voter registration campaign recently, saw an additional 1.6 million students register to vote across the UK, which will make a massive difference, especially in small constituencies. And, you know, thousands of those students were here in Northern Ireland. So I'm not really too fussed about it, to be honest.
Gotcha. Tom Kelly, just before we leave compulsory voting, what do you think about that?
I think a bigger issue is first past the post at general elections, which I think does produce unrepresentative results. I think it would be better to focus on that rather than compulsory voting.
And Tina McKenzie, just finally, as we wrap up this debate about voting, what do you think in terms of the turnout on Thursday? What do you think it's going to be roughly? Amwat was telling us it was around 62% last time.
Unfortunately, I think with everything that's going on, the timing, people's apathy levels, the fact that we've just got the Assembly back as well, I think there's a bit of a politics overload. They're being inundated with what's going on in America, with what's going on with Labour and Conservative. I hear a lot of people saying they're just switching it off because it's too depressing. So I think it'll be slightly less, unfortunately, which will hit some parties harder than others.
Amwat, what do you think?
I think the holiday period is bound to affect what's going on. You know, we've got a certain rise in postal votes, but some people won't have applied to the postal votes. It's not as straightforward as a process. So there's bound to be a decline in turnout, I would have thought. And then, you know, there's a lot going on politically. There's a confusion, I think, between what's happening, what's devolved and not devolved. You know, we've had Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer all over our media, but actually if they're talking about childcare or they're talking about energy policy or they're talking about jobs, that's all things that are decided for England and Westminster, not for Northern Ireland. So I think there's maybe a bit of a disconnect, really, for people here from what's going on in the Westminster debate. So I'd be surprised if turnout, well, if I had to put my money on it, which I won't be doing, by the way, but if I did, I would have thought below 60% would be my guess.
Below 60%. We've finally got somebody to put a number on it, Tom Kelly. Below 60%. What do you think?
I think it is bound to be down. I think it's bound to be down for two reasons. Number one, I think the holiday period will eat into it. But number two, this in Northern Ireland terms has been a relatively low-key campaign. And I think it's right. I think, you know, the Assembly has been taking the attention. That's where the real issue for Northern Ireland is at the moment. Can the executive be made to work? Westminster, I'm afraid, is a bit of a size show at the minute. So that's, I think, what will happen.
Tom Kelly, thank you. Speaking of sideshows, last question, Jude Ciarán Minto. We're going to be talking about this after the news. Are England going to win the Euros?
I wouldn't want to comment on that. I wouldn't want to represent all our students on that one.
I tell you what, you are going to make a great politician. What a diplomatic answer. Stay with us. Lots more to come after 10 o'clock. Right, did you see the football last night? Were England lucky? Or did it just take them a little while to show their class? Here's a reminder of exactly what happened.
Strelec's now on the edge of the area trying to get it down. It wouldn't bounce for him. Played into the box. Now the chance and the goal.
They have turned up here feeling like they can beat England today.
Oh, that's a good ball to Harris Lean down the left for Slovakia. Walker trying to get there. Harris Lean, deflection, cleared away. And somehow England survive. And we have now got only 15 minutes to play. England 15 minutes from going out, and this would be seen as an unmitigated failure in Gareth Southgate's last tournament in charge. but it's not over yet. We're into the penultimate minute. Here's the throw, flat to the near post, flicked on, overhead kick from Bellingham! It's 1-1! It's that man, Jude Bellingham! He's come up with the magic!
England off the hook. I mean, I just cannot believe we've got away with that performance in this stage of the game.
Kane is there! England score right at the start of extra time! From 1-0 down and almost out! Now and right at the start of extra time, Harry Kane with a close-range header!
How things can change at the drop of a hat in this game. It's crazy. Absolutely crazy.
We thought they were going home. Now, whisper it, it may be coming home. Yes, England could still win the Euros. What do you think? Give me a call. 0-30-30-80-55-55. I'll give you that number one more time. A BBC repeat. 0-30-30-80-55-55. One man was lucky enough to be there, and that's Miguel Delaney, sports writer at The Independent. Good morning.
Good morning.
What was it like?
To be honest, when it went in, scarcely believable given how poor England had been. And also, to be fair, Bellingham hadn't been that brilliant himself. There's actually been the kind of a wider debate around him. But I think this is something that is a real potential difference for England and something they haven't had before, which is a player with this kind of cast iron mentality. I mean, it is remarkable, even the way he speaks afterwards, and that manifested in a moment like that. And he is a real moments player. And as regards moments, this is something England genuinely haven't had before. They've never had a stoppage time or last minute equaliser to actually keep them in a tournament. The latest was Gary Lineker, who got an 82nd minute penalty against Cameroon in 1990. But that's not quite the same, given this was, 90 seconds from going out.
What were the England fans like in the stadium, Miguel?
So obviously, I suppose, I mean, Bellingham actually referenced this afterwards about some of the criticism from the fans. Now, and then his social media, of course, made a point of tweeting positively about the fans. I mean, obviously, there has been the capacity for mutiny, especially towards Gareth Southgate, where he got cups thrown at him after one of the games. This, from what I could sense, now we were right in the middle of the stadium, so pretty much between the two sets of fans, or in the middle of the stand. But it didn't really reach that level. There was obviously disquiet, frustration, groans, but it was always supportive. Now, it might have been different had it got to the 96th minute without any Bellingham equaliser. But in this, it was supportive. And that then obviously gave way to massive celebration and suddenly belief coursing through. But I think even from fans, there is still a kind of, like I'm talking to those afterwards and on public transport, there's still a bit of a kind of a this optimism, but still a bit of a qualification that a lot has to improve.
But there may just be that feeling that could be a turning point. As you say, it hasn't happened to England very often. We see it in club football all the time, and some teams are renowned for it, these last-minute winners, including my beloved Manchester United. But England aren't. This could be a big moment for them.
Yeah, and I mean, and that's exactly it. That is the kind of emotional effect of these moments. Also, it's only three games now, and there's obviously a wider debate about how good England are. Now, like even squads like the Spanish, the Italians, who are now out, they would actively talk about England as having the best squad in the tournament. But the best squad in the tournament actually doesn't necessarily translate into the best functioning team, which you've obviously seen. And like at the moment, they look a level way below Spain and below Germany. But in tournament football, that doesn't necessarily matter. Okay, generally, sides that perform like Spain win it, but there are plenty of examples of sides like Spain, not least Spain themselves, having one bad day that sends them out. And it does become about grinding through and that kind of sort of resilience, and a moment like that helps that.
Miguel, let's talk about Gareth Southgate. We have an expression over here. It's maybe a little lost in translation. Thran. Have you ever heard of the word thran? It means
I haven't actually.
It means stubborn. It's a great word. You can steal it from us. It means stubborn. There was something quite thran about Gareth Southgate last night. Everybody expected him to make wholesale changes at halftime or early into the second half. He didn't. And in the end, he was vindicated.
Yeah, and it was funny, actually. Immediately after the game, he did tell us it flashed across his mind for a second to take off Bellingham and Kane, but he kept them on precisely because of moments like that. And I think, yeah, I think you're right. I mean, there is this almost kind of external perception that Southgate is a bit kind of, not malleable, but he's too kind of attuned to what the media are saying, to kind of the prevailing trends. And actually, funnily, in great contrast to the history of how the English national team have been covered, I think there's been some discussion about the media are too soft on Southgate. Certainly, we've got it here from some fans. But actually, I think Southgate is very much his own man. As you say, there's a stubbornness about him, kind of a resoluteness. And he has made decisions that surprise people. And you can see it in the squad itself, where no one expected him to go as bold as he did with some of the picks and the youth players and some of the big players he left behind, like Rashford and Grealish. Now, he hasn't necessarily used that many of them. But yeah, he's stuck with this 11. But of course, there is a greater issue here. Slovakia, without willing to disrespect them, they're a good side, but they're still a side that England should be beating. The Swiss are, I would say, a level or two above that. Not to Spain's level, but they are a really improving side. Let's not forget as well, they got to the quarters of the Euros last time out in summer 2021, that was Euro 2020. They knocked out France in what was a shock, and then took Spain all the way to penalties. And there's almost a feeling that the Swiss team are growing to this next level. And I think against that, and we all saw how convincing Switzerland's performance was against Italy on Saturday, if they take on this England team as it was in the first half, there's a lot to exploit, and they've got a lot more quality. So I think Southgate still has to make change. Or sorry, it'd be shocking if he doesn't make changes.
Yeah. Well, talk us through their pathway to the final. You mentioned Switzerland. I don't know if it's going to be on the BBC or not, but I think it's been penciled in for 5 o'clock on Saturday afternoon.
ITV had yesterday's game, so the way they generally work is ITV, BBC, ITV. And then they all get the final, should England get there, of course. So it's Switzerland next, who, as I say, have been kind of one of the growing teams of the tournament, and a growing team in international football. There is this obviously perception, it's a fair perception, given Germany and Spain and France and Portugal are on one side, that England are on the more forgiving side of the draw. But that still doesn't necessarily mean it's easy. Okay, it's not as punishing, say, as either physically or mentally, as well as having to go through teams of potentially like Spain, Germany, France. But there are still really good sides on this side of the draw. The Swiss, as I say, are growing. Everyone is looking at Austria, because they're almost like a club team operating like an international team, because they've been because of the basically Ralf Rangnick, the manager, had instilled.
I remember him. I remember him from Old Trafford.
Well, he's in a very different context now, and he's in a context now where actually the federation, unlike Manchester United, have listened to a lot of his recommendations. Well, they've done more than listen to him. They've based the entire Austrian approach on an ideology that he introduced at Red Bull and at Hoffenheim, a German club, over a decade ago. And they're beginning to see the benefits of that, because suddenly he's got a squad of players that have come through this approach.
Miguel, I want you to listen to Malachy from Belfast, just to get a bit of a sense of how some people in Belfast feel about England. Malachy, how are you feeling this morning?
Mark, I'm actually trying to emigrate. You have no idea. Like, England are so bad. I reckon I could pick 11 guys from West Belfast in their 40s to give that team a run for their money. And the thing about it is, on paper, yes, they look as if they should do well, but they're just absolutely rubbish. Bellingham and Kane had a disastrous match. Only that fluky overhead kick, which any professional footballer will tell you, 9 of them would either go wide or over the bar, but unfortunately for the rest of us, it went into the net, and of course, it's coming home. But the only good thing from the whole, from watching it and listening to everything after it, Gareth Southall came on afterwards, Southgate came on and said, "Oh, it was a good performance." And Bellingham says, "Oh, we're doing well." Them Bloons think that performance was great. Every single pundit and person watching it
thought they were rubbish. You had on ITV, you had Gary Neville, you had Roy Keane, and you had
Ian Wright
saying he has to bring on five substitutes.
But that's my point. You heard me making it to Miguel. He was under pressure to do it. He stuck with what he had, and he was right in the end. And I think it was goal of the tournament from Jude Bellingham, no matter what you say, thinking that it's lucky.
How was he right? The guy was 90 seconds away from being hung, drawn, and quartered. And because of one part of, like, let's be honest, Bellingham and Kane had a disastrous match, but like England got a bye and
oh, Malachy's gone. Oh, I don't know where Malachy's gone. Miguel, are you still there?
Yeah, I am.
What do you make of Malachy?
I mean, I can understand the sentiment, but I'm hearing a lot of it from, as you can tell from my accent, from a lot of friends back home. He's probably right in terms of actual English performance, in terms of how poor it's been. And it's something we've actually that struck us from kind of covering the camp. They keep talking about how they're relaxed and they're not feeling the noise. And they go out and play as if they very much are feeling the noise. I mean, it shouldn't really go without mention. That was mostly a dreadful performance yesterday. It was almost as bad as when they went out against Iceland in 2016. But the massive difference, and Malachy's actually alluded to it there, the individual quality of the England players is arguably higher than it's ever been in history, Bellingham being one. And when you do have individuals like that, no matter how badly they're playing, they can produce moments. And that's exactly what happens. Now, if this was a league campaign, that is not a sustainable approach. But it's not a league campaign. It's three matches. Yeah. And in three matches now, individual moments, if you can just stay in games, they can take you a very long way.
A win's a win. A win's a win. Where do you stand on the overhead kick? Lucky or pure class?
I mean, like, just given Bellingham's history, given he tries this sort of thing, he has the will to do it, I would be closer to class, I have to say.
Dan is on the line from Lisburn. Hi, Dan.
Hello there, young fella. I think that was the result. It was truly a miracle. And I think it was God's answer to that priest in West Belfast who asked for God's intervention for England to lose. Now, there's only two footballers I know that have been touched by the hand of God. And one was Maradona, and the other one was that guy Bellingham who scored that miraculous goal yesterday. So, as an act of contrition, I think the priest in Belfast, for asking for God to do something which no Christian would really expect him to do, he should petition the Pope for to have Bellingham beatified, because truly he was touched by the hand of God.
Oh, Miguel, do you know what we're talking about here? I maybe need to explain this to you.
I just assume from the hand of God references Maradona, but
yeah. No, what happened on Thursday here, we had a priest in West Belfast at a service which was broadcast on the internet, and he was taking prayer requests. The context was a lot of very serious prayer requests, you know, people who were very ill or terminally ill, and then there was a little funny moment at the end of these prayer requests. We can hear it now.
Dear Mother of Perpetual Health, and this is a funny last one, but very serious too. Put England out of the Euros. We are still getting 1966. Please, you would never hear the end of it. A loving daughter with a sense of humor. P.S. I have been praying to P.O. as well.
Miguel, you can maybe tell from our curious history here, there is a bit of anti-England sentiment. A lot of it is tongue-in-cheek, and that was definitely tongue-in-cheek. But do you get that in Europe as well? I mean, you've been travelling around Germany. Is there any sense of anybody but England or not?
Not really, actually, I have to say. Not as pronounced as previous campaigns. Because, you've almost got to look at it another way now at this point. Kane is the biggest star in Germany, and while Bayern Munich are, it's a little bit like Manchester United in the 90s, actually. Well, they're, you know, either they're hated or adored. Half the country loves Bayern Munich, and the other half despise him. But it still makes Kane a massive star. Real Madrid are the biggest club in the world, and Bellingham is one of, at the moment, one of their, what, two or three biggest players. So, I mean, these are stars that people look up to, which has created a bit of a kind of a general European affection for the England team. The only thing, and it's funny, when you talk to both journalists here from other countries and fans, the one thing that keeps coming up is, how come Southgate can't make these players play better? For me, is the overriding theme with England. And the only reason people would want England, or the major sense I'm getting of why they'd want England to go out, is because they don't feel they're playing well enough to be champions.
Miguel, I'm going to come back to you in a minute, and you're going to tell me what's going to happen next and who's going to lift the trophy. Malachy, anything that Miguel has said has persuaded you to support England now?
I'm afraid not, Mark. And, you know, I want to know who I'm going to send my vet bill to, because I was eating chicken cousins at the time when he scored. Then he got stuck to the ceiling and the dog was kicked. It was just horrendous. The only good thing is, my biggest save was, I don't know if anybody was interested, but Galway beat Dublin in the football final, the Gaelic football in Croke Park.
Quarter final. And I hope you're only joking about kicking the dog. That's not funny.
No, the dog knows when England's playing. It normally goes out and sits underneath the car because it's just, as you said last week, everybody watches it, certainly from my part of the world, to see England getting beat. But when they do get beat, the competition loses interest because they're just so, we're going to win from day one. And you just want them to get beat. And they couldn't have set it up better than this going to be this Saturday. Actually, the viewing figures are going to be huge.
Hopefully the BBC get it. Malachy, thank you. Miguel, he's right. England are a soap opera. And I think secretly a lot of people are quite enjoying the fact they're still in the tournament. Who's going to win it?
At the moment, I'm going to go Spain. I think their performance, even after the England game last night, was sensational. They've been the best team by far. But it is a very difficult game against Germany, the host on Friday, who are pretty close to them. But yeah, I think Spain have something about them. But it is tournament football.
So call the final for us.
I think I'm going to go Spain-Austria for the final. I waver between Spain-England. A lot will depend on what Southgate does between now and the Swiss game. If he sticks to the same team, I think the Swiss will beat them. If he makes changes, England can get through and potentially get to the final. But we're dependent on those changes, I suppose. So for the moment, we're going Spain, Austria, and Spain to win.
We'll remember where we heard it first. We'll maybe speak to you again before the end of the tournament. That's the one and only Miguel Delaney. The time is 22 minutes past 10. Before we leave you this Monday morning, let's go to Spain, where Spanish police say they have called off the search for the missing British teenager in Tenerife, Jay Slater, 19 years of age, phoned a friend nearly 2 weeks ago to say he was lost in the mountains. This has been in all of the news coverage for the past fortnight. Sadly, Jay Slater hasn't been seen since. His family are not giving up, but the police in Tenerife announced at the weekend that they were calling off the search. Let's talk to Helena Vesti, who's a correspondent with the Manchester Evening News and is live for us in Tenerife. Good morning, Helena.
Morning. Thank you for having me.
What is the latest?
So, as you've mentioned, the really latest, you know, big development is the fact that police have now called off their search on the ground for Jay Slater. It's worth saying from the start that they're maintaining that the parallel investigation is continuing and that they will be accepting any new tips or information that might lead them to find where Jay has ended up. But for now, the search on the ground, which is around that kind of very mountainous region, very treacherous, quite dangerous terrain that people will have been so familiar with in this case, that has now been called off.
And was this a surprise when you think of the Madeleine McCann investigation in Portugal and the search for her, which sadly has never been successful? I don't remember it being called off quite so quickly.
It's really difficult to say because this search area, as I said, is so wild and so difficult to kind of muddle through. You, having been up there myself, you can kind of wander into, you know, an area of vegetation and completely disappear from view very quickly because it's just so thick. The ground underfoot is really unstable at points and it can be incredibly changeable in terms of the weather. The authorities did their last big push for a search on Saturday, and I went up there myself at about 8 a.m. and within around 10 minutes we'd had three different types of weather: baking hot, completely misty, and then even some winds and it getting quite cold. So searching in that type of area could take months if they were going to find any new evidence. So it's really difficult to say what the authorities should do in that situation.
And what are the family of Jay Slater saying?
So far, we've not heard from them since the search has been called off. I do understand that they're continuing to stay out here. We have heard friends of the family certainly say that they're not giving up and that they will be staying here in Tenerife to do everything they can to find Jay. However, Jay's dad, Warren, came up to the search site when the authorities were doing their last, you know, full day of searching on Saturday. And he quite rightly made the point that what can any of us sort of mere civilians do in that sort of terrain? Because if you're not an expert, it could get really dangerous for you up there. So, you know, their ability to search is somewhat limited.
Well, there is still hope. There is still hope. Helena Vesti from the Manchester Evening News. Let's hope that that search is successful. Just before we go, what a weekend for sport. Wasn't just at the Euros in Germany. What about in Dublin at Croke Park, where Dublin were beaten by Galway? On the line is the sports journalist with the Irish Independent, Conan Docherty. It opens up for the two Ulster teams, Donegal and Armagh now. Good morning, Conan.
Good morning. It has opened up everything. I think it's put a pep in everybody's step now. You know, finally, the unbeatable team have been beaten. And unfortunately for Derry, they couldn't join in that party. I mean, it opened up and you thought everybody's licking their lips here now. And Donegal, like you say, Armagh, like you say, they all took their chance. And Derry stumbled against Kerry. It could have been three Ulster teams and Galway, but we have the two anyway.
And for those who maybe don't follow it as closely as you, tell us how big a shock it is that Dublin aren't even in the semi-finals.
It's massive. Like, it is massive. Obviously, their record over the last 15 years has been incredible. The amount of All-Irelands they've gone and won, like, since 2011. And they haven't not been to a semi-final since then as well. So it's just been a massive shock. Galway are a very good team. But the way Dublin had been going, they've been playing such good football. They still had all the same old guard there playing. Maybe they are getting older. That's part of the post-mortem with them now. But they were the champions. They just seemed like they were on this trajectory that they were going to do it again. And they just put fear into everybody else. So when Galway came along and wiped them, and they just did it in the last 10 minutes as well. They took their chance and they took them out. And it's just given everybody that idea now that, oh my God, this is here. Like, this is here for us to win.
And for old romantics like me that loved the idea of Mickey Hart in his first full season at Derry, going to Croke Park and winning the Sam, it wasn't to be. And Derry in the end were a little bit disappointing against Kerry yesterday.
They were. Like, I think the biggest disappointment is that last year they played Kerry in the semi-final and they were absolutely brilliant. They were 2 points up with 7 minutes to go. Very unlucky not to get the job done, but the football they played, and they really put Kerry to the pin of their collar, and you were sort of proud as a Derry man going away thinking, geez, we really did something there, you know, and we're really going to look back on that fondly. But in this game, both teams shut up shop. It was one of those ones that everybody's going to spend a week now complaining about the state of Gaelic football. But they both were just respecting each other too much. They sat off, they held the ball. And when you lose a game like that, it's very disappointing because you think we didn't even throw a punch. And then if you win it, that's fine. You say we got the job done. But if you lose it, you feel like you've come away not really given it everything you could have.
And as an Ulster GAA fan, what are the chances of a Donegal Armagh final?
Well, you can't rule out Jim McGuinness for anything, really. You know, it's like he's just got this aura. And, you know, even if a lot of that is just the way we spread, just talk about Jim McGuinness's aura now, that still works. I mean, that feeds into it. He gets into the minds now of every opposition coach because because of all the talk we do about it, and obviously all the work that he does off the pitch as well. So, like, it's a big task for them playing Galway. Galway are a really good team, wiped out Dublin, but I wouldn't put it past Donegal to go into the final. Armagh have a bigger challenge against Kerry, but geez, it would be nice.
Call it for us, Conan, before I let you go. Who are going to be the All-Ireland champions of 2024?
I think Galway are going to beat Kerry, not to burst everybody's balloon and say no.
That was going so well, and you just burst our bubble there. That's Conan Docherty from the Irish Independent. This is Mark Simpson. I'm back tomorrow. Connor Phillips is next.
In the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet @StephenNolan.